The committee will come to order, please. We have a quorum. Good morning. Good morning, Representative Wardlaw. I just wanted to point out Representative Wardlaw, and I thought this to Representative Marquardt. They did list all the Apple Valley coaches for the wrestling squad, and I noticed most of them were math teachers. So, at least there isn't a connect there. Yes, here we go. Members, we do have a quorum. In your packet are the minutes from our last meeting. If you would take a moment to look over those minutes. Members, do I have a motion to approve? Representative Brown moves approval of the minutes of the Thursday, March 9th meeting. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, this morning we have one bill on our agenda. It is the Department of Education's administrative bill. This morning, what I would like to do is welcome the Commissioner of Education in the state of Minnesota, Commissioner Alice Seagren, to provide us with some opening remarks and then introduce the staff that's here to testify. Welcome, Madam Commissioner. Members, the chair is inclined at this point to hear testimony on the bill, to hear questions concerns and support brought forward by members of the public, and near the end of this meeting, or at the end of this meeting, lay this bill over for a couple of days to get further input before bringing it back up to vote on the piece of legislation. And if there's any change, I'll be working with Representative Dorn as we move forward on this. Good morning, Madam Commissioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. It's good to be here. And in fact, I apologize for not being here at the opening of session when the session started and your committee started. I ended up being sick in bed for about 8 days and just finally recovering, and so I'm glad to be here today with you all.
And it's good to see you in good health, Madam Commissioner.
Thank you. I appreciate that. House Bill 3179 is the department bill, and I'm not going to make a lot of comments, only to draw your attention to the fact that we have four amendments. Two are in regard to our Article 3 special education article, to do some clarification and corrections in that article. And when our special ed folks get up here, they can explain those. Article 1, of course, is just much of it is technical clarification in regard to finance areas. As I said, in Article 2 is our education excellence article that covers some adjustments, technical adjustments there. Article 3, of course, is special ed. Article 4 has a repealer of a report that districts were required as far as the revenues and expenditures. We heard from various groups that they did not want that repealed, so what we tried to do is make it a more manageable and practical process for our school districts by changing the date of reporting to make it more realistic to their actual numbers, and then allow some web reporting for them that would be a little bit less expensive than the current process. But that's all I will say. I want to get us right into the actual bill, so I'd like Dr. Melcher to come up and begin explaining Article 1.
Madam Commissioner and members of the committee, what the chair will do in respects to introducing this bill is we will cover all of the articles one at a time. However, we'll bypass Article 3 because there are a number of people who want to testify to that also. So we'll take Articles 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, ask questions as they arise, members of the committee. Then we will introduce Article 3, have the department speak to it, bring up any people in the audience who'd like to speak to it, all right, and move in that direction.
Mr. Chair, can
Madam
I just ask a process question also? How do you want to handle the amendments? The amendments that are applicable to Articles 1, 2, 4, that would be amendments AO6 1160. As we go through the articles, do you want Dr. Melcher to also just point out the amendments. How would you like that?
Madam Commissioner, what I will do right now, and members of the committee, if you could have the amendments before you, because these are all department amendments to get the bill into the shape that they would like to speak to it, I would prefer to move these amendments one at a time at this point so that when we begin speaking about the bill, it is in the shape that the department would like it spoken to. So members, if you would, and I got to ask a technical question here. Members, if you would please, I have in front of me the A061189 amendment. First, I better do this. Members, I would like to move House File 3179 before the committee. And so now we have a proper motion and the bill is before the committee. Members, I have in front of me amendment A061189. And as the author of the bill, I'd like to incorporate that into the bill. Members, I have before me the A061185 amendment. And as the author of the bill, I'd like to incorporate that amendment into the bill. Members, I have before me the A061188 amendment, and as the author of the bill, I'd like to incorporate that amendment. Finally, members, I have before me amendment A061160, and as the author of the bill, I'd like to incorporate that amendment. And so now, Madam Commissioner, the bill is in the shape the department would like it spoken to. If I could just ask that the department staff ensure that when we get to those places, we know what we're speaking to at that point, I'd appreciate it. Madam Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Melcher, welcome to the committee.
Tom Melcher, Director of Finance at the Department of Education. I'm going to walk through the Article 1 of the bill. Article 1, Section 1, is relating to the age limitation for pupils enrolled in Minnesota public schools, and it is clarifying the age limit on free public school enrollment. The primary language is on page 2, lines 11 through 15 of the bill. This is reflecting the department's longstanding practice in interpreting the age 21 limitation such that students who turn age 21 during their year of school continue to be eligible for free public enrollment through the end of the school year. And this is putting that, codifying that into law. There is part of the A1185 amendment, page 2, line 11, after continued, we would be inserting free public school enrollment at that juncture. There are provisions that allow students to enroll in school after they turn 21, but it's no longer guaranteed to be free, and in those situations, a school board has an option to enroll the students and also an option to charge a fee. So this is clarifying. This is the limit on free public school enrollment. Article 1, Section 2.
Mr. Melcher, if you could hold. Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, Dr. Melcher. Just a clarifying question. If I'm understanding you correctly, this language allows students who turn 21 during an academic year to complete that academic year, but does not deal with the issue that Representative Greiling raised last year, particularly students coming out of refugee camps without having attended school, who are older and are in need of education services in this country. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, you are correct. This is simply codifying the current department practice in terms of administering the age 21 limitation. There are also provisions in law. Actually, in the A 1185 amendment, there are some technical changes being made to the existing provision that deals with students over 21. And for those students, it becomes discretionary on the part of the school board to admit those students to a program, and also the school board can determine if it will charge a fee. But under current Minnesota law, there is no general education aid paid for those students who are over 21.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Melcher.
Article 1, Section 2 of the bill deals with the accounting for the QCOMP revenue program, and it would require school districts to establish a reserve account in the general fund if they are participating in the QCOMP program and they do not spend the full amount of revenue that they earned for the year. So it's simply setting aside any unexpended balance that the school district would have for QCOMP to ensure that it would be used for QCOMP in the following years rather than going into the school district's unreserved general fund and being used for a different purpose. Article 1, Section 3 of the bill is amending the QCOMP statute also, and it is correcting an error that was made in last year's bill relating to the calculation of the limits on funding for charter schools in years after 2008. The intent of the legislation last year was to have that limit on charter schools, which is set at $3.3 million for fiscal 07, float in the future depending on the enrollment in the charter school statewide. And there was a drafting error in the bill last year which had the language work correctly for the first year, fiscal 08, but it did not work correctly for later years. And this is basically taking that $3.3 million and having that float depending on the ratio of the charter school enrollment in the current year, or the most recent year, to the charter school enrollment in fiscal 06, which was used to drive that $3.3 million. And what this will do essentially is to ensure that the level of funding for the charter schools and for the traditional public schools remains proportionate to the level of enrollment in the two segments of the overall public school community. Mm-hmm. Article 1, Section 4 is another of several amendments that are dealing with the age 21 clarification. And there are a couple of amendments to this language here. One of the amendments on page 4, line 19, would delete the new language, the in kindergarten through grade 12. That was viewed as being unnecessary. Another amendment on page 4, line 21, and this is on the 1185 amendment, would insert, after the comma, those enrolled under section 124D02, subdivision 2. This this section of law deals with what students are eligible to be enrolled in an area learning center, and it's simply deleting some confusing language dealing with adults 22 and older and replacing it with a cross-reference to the high school graduation incentives program, which is 124D.68, and also adding a cross-reference to the other statute that I had cited earlier, which is included in the 1185 amendment as well, which allows for the enrollment of students who are over 21. Some of this language is necessary because of the elimination of the adult graduation incentive program a few years ago, and this is to align the programmatic language with that in order to clarify the financial status for students who are 21 and over.
Representative Greiley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melcher, would you explain that one more time, what you're doing with the ALC students?
Okay.
Dr. Melcher.
Page 4, or this is Section 4 of the bill, and these are the ALC students. Currently, the law says that pupils eligible to be served are those age 5 to adults 22 and older. That language has created some confusion in the past. Last year, we had a bill that would have changed the age 22 to age 24. and the office of the bill thought that that would provide additional funding for students who were age 24. Well, really, that wouldn't have provided additional funding because there's another law that governs the funding for students over 21. So what we're doing here is striking that confusing reference to the age 22 and older, simply cross-referencing the reference to 124D68 Subdivision 2 is the High School Graduation Incentives Program, which now applies only to students who are under 21. The new language that we would be inserting here, those enrolled under Section 124D02 Subdivision 2, and for cross-reference, if you look at the 1185 amendment, you'll see the language of 124D02 Subdivision 2, which is the provision which allows a school district, including an ALC, to enroll a student over age 21 at the school board's discretion and to provide funding, which the school board would decide to either cover that from other budget means or to charge a fee. Again, in response to Representative Dabney's earlier question, there's nothing in this bill that would reinstate the funding for students over 21 from state sources. This is just simply clarifying the current law as we know it today.
Thank you.
Dr. Melcher.
Okay. Article 1, Section 5 is another clarification dealing with the QCOMP legislation that was enacted last year. And this relates to the requirement for school districts to report the revenues and expenditures by school building. And what this is doing is adding a cross-reference to the QCOMP revenue so that the QCOMP revenue will be reported by building rather than being prorated on a district-wide basis. So, for example, in a school district like Minneapolis, where some buildings are participating in the QCOMP program, other buildings are not participating, this would allow the school board to reflect the QCOMP revenue accurately in the schools that actually get the money rather than just prorating it across all schools for reporting purposes on a uniform basis. The next section of the bill, Section 6, is another section clarifying the age 21 issue, and this is the High School Graduation Incentives Program, and the language on page 5, line 25 and line 26 is clarifying the age 21 reference, that students eligible include those who are under 21 and those who are basically turning 21 during their senior year. Article on page 6, on 6.9 through 6.17, we are striking the language which used to drive the High School Graduation Incentive Program, which provided high school graduation incentive aid to certain students who were over 21 who had received fewer than 14 years of public education or met certain other requirements. So this is being stricken here, consistent with the elimination of the adult graduation aid for that particular group of students. Section 7 of the bill is also related to the age 21 issue. On page 6, line 24 through 26, are striking references to students over 21, which this becomes an obsolete cross-reference because of Clause B here dealing with students over 21 being eliminated up in the previous section of the bill. On page 7 of the bill at the top, again relating to the age 21 issue, this is clarifying that pupils under 21 or who meet the requirements of 128.20 are eligible to generate pupil units. Again, this is consistent with current practice. Section 9 of the bill deals with the calculation of sparsity aid, and it clarifies that charter schools are not considered in the calculation of sparsity aid for regular schools. Calculation of sparsity aid for charter schools is based on a state average calculation We had a question come up last year dealing with the elementary school in Tofty, where there was also a charter school in Tofty, and the question came up, was the regular small public school somehow losing its status as a sparsity aid district because a charter school had also opened in the same town? And our answer was no, that the location of a charter school would not affect the eligibility of the regular public school in that community for sparsity aid. And this is codifying that department interpretation that a regular school would not lose sparsity aid because a charter school came in within 19 miles of that school. Section 10 deals with the calculation of the unemployment insurance levy. This amendment is clarifying the current department practice, which is that if a school district had built up a fund balance in the unemployment levy account because of an overestimate of their cost, that the department, instead of taking all the money back in 1 year, would reduce the subsequent levy authorities of the district for unemployment insurance until that excess fund balance had been used up. Section 11 of the bill deals with the Safe Schools levy, and this is doing two things. The language on page 9, line 14, is requiring a school district to reserve any unspent balance for this purpose rather than having it go into the unreserved general fund to be used for other purposes. It also is clarifying that the requirement for a school district to work with the local law enforcement is limited to Clause 1 of the bill, which deals with the hiring of law enforcement officials for liaison with the schools and does not preclude a district from instead deciding to use the dollars for other safe schools activities within the school district. This is the result of some questions that we had from the counties in administering this law. Section 12 of the bill would authorize the department to advance a school district's state-paid tax credits in the debt service fund as well as the debt service equalization aid. Currently, if a district has a cash flow problem in the debt service fund, the department is allowed to advance the debt service equalization aid, but not the state paid tax credits. This would treat the two categories of state aid consistently and could potentially help the department to enable a school district to avoid a late payment on a debt service obligation. Section 13 of Article 1 is repealing 120A20, which earlier version had the actual. Okay, and this is dealing with admission to public schools for age 21. This again is related to the series of technical amendments that we have dealing with students over 21, and is consistent with current department practice.
Thank you, Mr. Melcher. Seeing no questions, Madam Commissioner, we'll move on to Article 2.
All right. We have Ms. Roberts and Ms. Oni. Ms. Oni, do you want to come up here, too, just to save some time? Mm-hmm. There you go.
Good morning, Ms. Roberts, Ms. Oni. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony on Article 2, Education Excellence.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Amy Roberts with the Department of Education.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Beth Oni with the Department of Education.
Welcome.
I'm going to start with Section 1. And this is one of the provisions that has one of the amendments. If you look at Amendment A06-1160, this Section 1 deals with a residency issue that actually arose during a special education complaint that reached the department. And it dealt with a situation where a student who was already going to school in a particular district, a dispute arose over the residency of that student, and the student was then removed from school. And what we are asking for here in the statute is that before a removal like that occurs, some minimum due process be given to the family. And we've defined minimum due process to be notice and an opportunity to be heard. And that is basically, we envision the school boards being the architects of what that, how they further define what that minimum due process looks like.
Continue on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm doing Section 2 on benchmarks. The department has introduced an amendment to delete our language, which would have effectively changed the standards revision cycle.
So, Ms. Arnie, is that on the same amendment that was previously referenced, the 1160 amendment?
Yes.
All right, so members, on the 1160 amendment, I believe it's page 1, line 6. It says on page 11, delete lines 4 to 21, and so that would be all of Section 2. So Section 2 is now deleted from this bill. Representative Geiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Segrin, do you feel that the department is staffed well enough to adhere to current law rather than your proposed change?
Commissioner Segrin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Geiling, our intent would be we're looking at a more realistic revision. We may come back with a different timetable, but we're trying to work that out right now. We think that we could be ready to do some revisions in math in maybe a year. But we're trying to work through the revision so that we can, it comes into a more logical sequence. As you know, we just got done with our MCA2s as far as establishing new MCA2s. And we want to make sure that we've got, those in place and, but also still have a revision cycle that, we intended to have as we go forward. So instead of doing this, we decided temporarily now to hold that off until we can get more of a, management of this. And yes, it will cause a lot of extra work for our staff, and our staff is staffed fairly thin right now. But that's not really the reason. We're trying to get a more realistic process in place here in the future so that we can handle it and do a more thoughtful job with the revisions, not have, two or three at all at one time, but have one cycle. So we will be getting back to you on that and talking with you on that and with the rest of the committee.
Mm-hmm. Continuing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm doing Section 3 now. This is on reimbursement for exam fees for the CLEP exam. Our language eliminates the requirement that bases the reimbursement of exam fees on students earning a satisfactory score on the CLEP exam. So this language would, in effect, make the process for reimbursement of CLEP exams the same as we have for advanced placement and international baccalaureate exams.
Section 4 is a clarification of some data reporting requirements that come to the department. This is also affected by an amendment, same amendment on line 1.7. What we gather at the department, school districts are required to report their expulsion data. We have learned or are aware that there are some removals for greater than 15 days that are not termed or called or considered expulsions, but are still a removal of the student in excess of 15 days. And what we've ended up having is sort of a disparate picture of what's going on in school districts, where we have the expulsion data for some districts, but no removal data at all reported by other districts. And so it's an incomplete picture. So we are attempting to sort of make our data more consistent and then usable for subsequent decision-making.
Representative Kylan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Roberts, I'm just wondering about, back to Section 3, sorry to be slow on the draw here, but why are we eliminating the reimbursement only for successful students? Are we finding that some students legitimately need to take it more than once and we don't want to penalize them for that opportunity?
Mr. Chair?
Madam Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Browning. The reason why we're not requiring them to successfully pass a test before they're reimbursed is because of what we feel might be discriminatory and discouraging practices for minority students. They may not even want to attempt to take a test. In the advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs, we do not require that they successfully pass a test before they're reimbursed for the exam fee. And I actually, the College Board called us about this and were very concerned and felt that it would be very discouraging. And it's not the practice for any of the other reimbursements. And they were very distressed about the fact. And actually, what happened is last year during conference committee, this was not supposed to have been in here. It was agreed to by conferees that this was not going to be a condition of the payment. But as we were getting our last-minute things together, it actually ended up staying in the bill. And so this is actually a correction. Both Senator Kelly and Representative Biskin actually signed a letter of intent agreeing that we had not intended this to happen at the end of session. So this is just really a clarification, a correction of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a very good change.
Mm-hmm. Question, Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Segrin, I'm wondering how many times they can take the test and get reimbursed for it.
Madam Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, I understand that, let's say if they took a math test and they passed it, they'd be reimbursed. I would ask if they failed the test. I don't think that they would continue to try to attempt to take it. With the AP exam, for example, they have the opportunity to take the test at the end of the course. If they fail it, they fail it. They don't, take the course over again. Maybe someone else from the department has that answer. And Representative Severson, we can get that. Or is that true? Okay. Ms. Downey is concurring with me.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So they would basically take it once. If they failed it, they would get reimbursed for it. They would not take it again.
Ms. Allen.
Ms. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Precht.
Right. Representative Kemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Segrin or whoever else, the information about the exclusions, expulsions, or other removals, what's done with that information at the department?
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have a discipline incident reporting system, the DIR system, which collects the student discipline data that is required to be collected depending on various laws, whether they be federal or state. And basically, we have it until somebody requests it.
Representative Seibert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Severson's question, are they precluded from retaking the test, or they just normally don't? Personal choice.
Ms. Sonny.
Mr. Chair, Representative, normally they would choose not to. But this is hypothetical, my response, because this hasn't been administered yet. But most students, typically when they take a test and do poorly on it, would not want to retake it again.
So, Ms. Ani, I think you flagged this issue because it might be one that comes up in a year or so from now as an issue. Commissioner.
Oh, go ahead. Question five. This is not affected by an amendment. This is the original online learning language that was passed a few years ago. The department has heard some concerns from various families that the way the language as it exists now in law is potentially discriminatory against special education students. And so the department's proposal is just to strike that language and assume all students have equal access to the online learning provisions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Weber.
Thank you. That just seems counterintuitive. But you're telling us that this actually makes it easier for kids with special needs to get this as opposed by saying that they may do it. Is that
Ms. Roberts. And Representative. The concern that we heard was the language as it exists now requires the IEP team to make a decision about accessing online learning versus the idea that if a parent wants to opt for online learning, the parent opts for online learning, then the IEP team meets to determine how to work that program together.
Fine, thank you.
Okay. I believe we're on to Section 6.
This is Dr. Melcher.
Dr. Melcher, Section 6.
Members Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. This amendment would make a slight change in the notification that a charter school provides to the school district and to the department regarding transportation. Currently, charter school is required to notify the department and the district if it will provide its own transportation, but not if it wants transportation from the district. This would have the school, have the charter school provide notification one way or the other. In other words, to positively say whether it is requesting transportation or whether it will provide its own transportation. It's an effort just to try to improve the communication so that there's a clear decision made by the charter school one way or the other. We did have an issue this past year with the St. Paul School District where there was some debate about what, you know, did the charter school notify or not notify the school district of its desires with regard to transportation. This would just simply put in law that the charter school is required to notify the district whether it wants transportation or whether it doesn't want transportation. It just gives an answer one way or the other.
Mr. Melcher, I noticed, okay, there is a timeline there also by July 1st. All right, very good. Section 7.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jessie Montano. I'm with the NCLB programs.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Montano.
Thank you and good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Section 7 is asking districts to establish some minimum program requirements for serving ELL students. The minimum program requirements are in three parts. First of all, it's asking districts to establish some identification and reclassification criteria as well as program entrance and program exit criteria. Secondly, that a district establish a written plan under the minimum that plan includes the scope of service and the amount of time that students are getting service. And then finally, that professional development opportunities be provided to all teachers that provide some form of instruction to ELL students, be it the ESL or bilingual teacher, but also the regular classroom teacher, which is very important since these students spend the bulk of their time in the classroom.
Ms. Montano, just a question. Where did the impetus for this new language come from?
Mr. Chair, we feel that there has been funding for ELL programs now for a number of years. With the accountability measures for ELL students, that it's important that districts really give it some careful consideration in terms of their expectations for these students so that these students can score at a level of proficiency on the test for emerging academic language skills and also for the MCA2s.
Ms. Montana, is there any concern that this would place a greater burden on a school district that that's a small school district with maybe one or two ELL students and having to create a district-wide plan and program versus a district that receives a large amount of additional dollars because they have a greater percentage of the student body as ELL students?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did discuss that to some degree, but if you look, it's not asking the district any specifics. It leaves it up to the district to determine the scope of program and the length of the plan. It's simply just asking the district to give it some consideration in terms of what is an appropriate service, but it is not setting any parameters or any type of due process requirements in the least. So we don't feel, because of that, that it is going to place any undue responsibility onto district staff.
Right. Ms. Montano, I guess I'm just looking at page 14, line 31, particularly when it comes to the professional development opportunities and the additional funding. As I said before, if I look up on page 14, line 21, School district is going to be required to have these professional development opportunities, even if it's just one ESL student, and they're getting the funding. Additional funding is based on your number of students, and therefore providing spreading the professional development opportunities for one teacher based upon 30, 40, 50 students and the additional revenue from there versus just one student does appear to me to place a higher burden on a smaller school.
Mr. Chair?
Madam Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Melcher just reminded me that if you have one student, one ELL student, you actually get funded as if you had 20. So that there is resources available for that one teacher that's maybe serving one student. There should be adequate resources to help support the education of those.
Thank you for that clarification, Madam Commissioner. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, or anybody else. Ms. Montano, I'm looking at page 14, line 23, and identification and reclassification criteria, thinking of the fact that funding, you know, follows whoever is identified. Don't we have state identification criteria? Does this mean every district would be developing their own?
Ms. Montagna.
Representative Grayling, Mr. Chair, the identification and reclassification in one sense is dependent upon, first of all, whether the student comes from a home where language other than English is spoken and there's a home language questionnaire that verifies that there is another language involved, and then the student is not able to function successfully in a classroom where English is the predominant language being spoken. So the identification and reclassification in one sense is more or less already established. However, when it comes to reclassification, there are students who are still considered to be ELL and maybe are only getting monitored as opposed to full service, and so we want to make sure that those students don't fall between the cracks. So we're asking the school districts to give it some thought in terms of at what point do you not provide full service, at some point where do you monitor the student, at some point do you make sure that you're aware that they're not quite where they should be, but you're not providing full service and they're not falling between the cracks. So that is up to the district.
Representative Brown.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Montano, this is criteria for how the local district interprets the state law.
Ms. Montano.
Representative Brown, Mr. Chair, there is entrance criteria in the sense that you are affect your ability to perform in an all English speaking classroom. Is not giving you equal opportunities because you don't understand the language. So that is clear in the sense of I come from a home and there's another language involved and that's preventing me from participating in the classroom. So in with respect to interpretation of the law, I think we've been functioning along the criteria since this law was first developed. It's the other end where, yes, we do have a TEAE, Test of Emerging Academic English, as well as MCAs, which does have a score of proficiency, and so that is one measure in terms of exiting, but sometimes we have students who don't reach that score, but then services are either decreased or no longer are provided. There is a five-year limit on the amount of funding, so we just want to make sure that at a minimum those students continue to be monitored or make sure that they get some kind of support service through Title I or through basic skills so that they don't fall between the cracks. And so this is really asking districts to think about what you're doing with these students and set at least some minimum expectations for them.
We'll move on to Section 8. Madam Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Mark Volke. I serve as executive director for the Board of School Administrators.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Volke.
Thank you. The board is seeking regular rulemaking. Last legislative session, it was granted expedited rulemaking. And the board took a look at the expedited rulemaking. Last summer, we created two task forces, one to work on rule language cleanup that would fit the expedited rulemaking. and we have language ready for the supervisor at this time. The board also took a look at the age of the language and under which all school administrators are licensed, and the competencies for school administrators. And we find that currently there are some competencies missing, especially for principals. And the task force that is taking a look at the competencies has found and wishes to add a safety and security competency, which is currently missing, and also one called intercultural leadership, which they would also like to add. There's a lot of confusion and has been a lot of confusion regarding the language. If you start taking a look at what is the principal, what does it take to be licensed as a principal, the language points you to this section, that section, and another section in order to try to gain some language clarity in it. Much of my time is spent answering to people who are interested in seeking a principal's license in Minnesota. And they're very confused, even if they take a look at the language. So I usually have to provide that kind of interpretation.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Belke.
Thank you.
Madam Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll do Section 9.
Ms. Arnie.
Section 9, the language provides flexibility in administration of advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs. Currently, unused funds for teacher training can't be accessed for exam fee reimbursement, so this language would allow us to do that. Also, the current language states that the subsidy should be the same for both AP and IB training, but this isn't possible since the various kinds of training cost different amounts. The registration and other kinds of fees vary. We're also introducing an amendment to this language that would permit the unused appropriation set aside for teacher training to be used for student exam fees.
And one of the spot is on the 1160 amendment, lines 1.8 through 1.11, I believe.
Yes.
You see no questions? Thank you. Section 10.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daniel Bittman from Educator Licensing and Teacher Quality at the Department of Education.
Welcome, Mr. Bittman.
Thank you for the opportunity. Section 10 is, there is an amendment 061160 that would allow language to include teachers at charter school, since tenure is not usually given in a charter situation. However, the language would allow a tenured licensed science teacher to add a 912 science field bypassing the practice to content test in that field, with the idea that they already have the pedagogy, they're successful in the classroom, so they would be able to add that through the practice series. There is currently approximately 637 permissions, special permissions granted by the Board of Teaching in science-related fields, and we have seen that throughout Minnesota, not only here in the cities, but throughout rural Minnesota, there's an absolute need to encourage teachers to demonstrate that they are qualified through that practice series. Mm-hmm. Individuals taking that test would be required to get the same passing score as any other teacher, licensed science teacher, by the board-approved test.
Mr. Bittman, question. Why, help me understand why we would require either tenured or 3 consecutive years in a school district. If an adult, a professional, has gone through a licensing program and has been deemed competent enough to hold a license in the state of Minnesota, why would we then say, I'm not understanding why we'd say they have to have 3 consecutive years in a single district. So if I could have up to 4 years and not be eligible. This seems almost discriminatory to rural schools and your smaller schools who have a tough time holding teachers. I understand that. And have the greatest need for having multi-licensed, multi-area licensed science teachers. I'm not not, I don't understand why we would make that kind of requirement. So if you can help me with that.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, committee members, that discussion came about quite frequently. And as you know, the Department of Education worked with MREA, the Rural Education Association, the Board of Teaching, Board of School Administrators, the education unions, et cetera. And that was somewhat of a compromise so that everyone would buy into that system. As far as the part about the 3 years, that's particular just for those charter schools because they do not tenure their teachers. And so a smaller rural district, for example, would be covered with the tenure with the 3 years. But the board absolutely supports and believes in the licensing credentials that are currently in place and would support that either way.
Mr. Bittman, would the board support simply eliminating the word tenure on line 16.22 and then eliminating the new language which was brought forward with the amendment?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I would defer to Alan Hoffman, who I know is in the audience, the Executive Director of the Board of Teaching at this time. Alan?
Mr. Hoffman.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Hoffman.
Could you state your question again?
Mr. Hoffman, the question I have is, would the board support on page 16, line 22, first to delete the new language that was brought forward on the 1160 amendment, and then to delete the word tenured?
This is one of the provisions that the board requested a year ago, and we worked in collaboration with the Department of Education in support of this. We feel strongly that this 3 years is an opportunity for a new teacher to demonstrate competency and understanding of the science pedagogy, and therefore we would be in support of maintaining the word tenure in this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Is there any further questions? Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand your comment, but if a first-year teacher does take the test and is allowed to teach that course, wouldn't he, for 3 years, be observed and practice his trade in that subject and they'd evaluate how he's doing?
Mr. Hoffman.
Anyway?
Yes, our concern is that a teacher, for example, graduating in the spring with a degree in life science might, as a condition of employment, be asked to study and take a test in physics and chemistry or potentially up to three other areas. Science educators have told us repeatedly over the years that the amount of content that a person needs to understand in order to teach any one of these areas, four science areas, is immense, and to burden a new science teacher who has not had science teaching experience with having to understand the content and the pedagogy. Their science licenses are discrete in that there is an understanding that there is different pedagogy required to teach life science and physics, for example. And we understand that there is some transferability between the pedagogy for life science and physics, and feel that if a teacher has 3 years of experience working in one area, that person would begin to understand that transferability, and then it would make sense to be able to add another license after having a recommendation from an administrator, which tenure would require.
Representative Woodrow?
Okay. I don't know if I agree with you.
Representative Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You bring up an excellent point here, Mr. Chair. And a question I have is, in a lot of, I want to say, smaller and even medium-sized schools, you may have one teacher that teaches the physical and the earth sciences and that sort of thing. And I know in some of the schools that I represent, they do waivers when they have a need for that. Can you? And I'm not sure who does the waivers, if it's the department or if it's the board. I think the department is the board.
Yes.
Can you tell me about waivers given to teachers in their first 3 years of teaching? Are we doing waivers so we do indeed have newer teachers teaching outside of their licensure on a waiver?
There are waivers, and actual variances are granted as well during the first 3 years of licensure. I do have to mention that this requirement for that the board is interested in seeing for 3 years is, again, a compromise. We have board members who feel very strongly that any type of licensure by test is bad professional practice, and this guarantee of 3 years represents a compromise on the part of the board that everybody can live with.
Representative Stammer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me the waivers that are granted, are they based in any kind of test or any kind of criteria other than recommendation of administration or a school board? And particularly with teachers who have less than 3 years who do not have tenure.
Mr. Hoffman.
No, variances are granted upon the request of an administrator. We put our trust in the integrity of administrators. That person is making a decision what's best for their school.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So, Mr. Chair, we would have a teacher with 1 or 2 years of experience who maybe hasn't passed this praxis to teaching in these multiple areas, and yet another teacher who maybe can pass the praxis to can't teach, and I'm just wondering if we're consistent there in the way we're applying this. I have to agree with the chairman, my friend the chairman, in this case, removing tenured or the three-year between the recommendation of administration and the school board, who you just said is good a good indicator, and being able to pass this practice, it seems to me it would be a consistent and good policy to have that the same. Because I can't see where there'd be a difference. So if they can't pass the test, they just apply for the waiver and get it, and that doesn't seem right.
Representative Clemson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Dummer asked the questions I had, because I'm confused by the fact that this seems to raise the standard for the 600 variances and waiver teachers we have out there. And the board has come back with a compromise that they said we'll keep the standard high, yet it seems that we're still going to have to issue a number of variances and waivers that won't reach this standard that's been put into the statute. The teachers won't have reached this standard. So we're still going to have the same problem. And so, thank you.
Representative Easton. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to disagree with my good friends Biskins and Demmer and agree with my good friend Wardlow, Representative Wardlow, on this one. But, you know, I think Representative Clemson's question is a good one, but I think this language that we have before us, along with the opportunity for waivers, does both. You know, it says that we do want the highest standard for teachers, as research shows us, helps children in schools. We have the highly qualified teachers with No Child Left Behind, but yet we have to recognize facts in some of the districts where they don't have enough teachers to teach all the subjects, and then, you know, it's a lesser thing that's good for kids, but yet it helps school districts out at a pinch where waivers can be granted. So I think we have the best of both worlds with what is ideal, but then recognizing practicalities. And I think it's also an added insurance for students if the administrator recommends that teacher for the variance. It's not just any first-year teacher. You know, when I was a first-year teacher, it took me 3 years to figure out where to put the Kleenex box. You know, maybe I wouldn't have gotten a waiver, and maybe Representative Wardlow, you know, knew where to put his and would have gotten one, you know, and I think that has to be factored in when you have less than ideal.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Biskins. Representative Greiling, what you're saying is at least questioned by me in that at least taking the praxis is affirmation that the teacher knows the content. A principal may recommend a waiver or a variance because he or she needs a teacher. But taking the praxis is a guarantee that they know the content, because they have to pass praxis to get the license that's set down in Section 10. So I would disagree that either tenured or 3 years in a school district or a waiver, any one of those is better than having the praxis as the basis for licensure. A district may be sitting around for 3-4 years with a waiver teacher, not knowing whether or not the teacher has content. Let's say it's a biology teacher who seeks licensure in chemistry and is willing to take the praxis. I think we're doing a disservice here to both children and teachers by making this language so restrictive and then arguing that waivers and variances are better?
Thank you. We have one person who is asked to testify to Article 2, Mr. Deans. Would you come forward, please? As he's coming down, Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Chair Biskins. And Commissioner Seagram, I was wondering, this may be the time to open up this discussion. Has there been any movement at all, and we look at the shortage of science teachers generally tend to be in outstate Minnesota, and yet at the same time, we have a lot of ag teachers out there that take a lot of science courses, and they have a heavy emphasis in science. Has there ever been a thought of qualifying these ag teachers to teach science?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Heidgerken, that's actually a question that you should be, addressing to the Board of Teaching.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that set the licensure regulations and rules, not the Department of Ed. We just staff the Board of Teaching. We certainly asked our opinion. And if you want my opinion, I think that it would be helpful to have a process by which ag teachers can demonstrate their knowledge. Certainly they could also demonstrate their knowledge through a praxis test. That would be a very quick way of demonstrating that so that they would be able to teach science courses. I'm very interested in trying to actually upgrade or to assure the skill level of a lot of our career technical teachers so that we can start really engaging them in a lot of more high-level, rigorous vocational education programs for our kids, because we really need to be addressing that much more aggressively. And I do know that we don't have as many of those types of teachers as we have had in the past because of the shrinkage of our career and technical programs. So, certainly we would be willing to work with you on the issue. I certainly support quality, and how we get there is certainly a lot of discussion. But you could ask the Board of Teaching about if they've been exploring that in that area too.
Mr. Deans, Article 2.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. Mr. Chair, we have not had a real opportunity to meet with the department on a couple of these provisions that are in this article. We are going to meet with them later today, but just I want to raise a couple of concerns with Sections 1, 4, and 5 of Article 2. Section 1 is the one that that dealt with the residency stuff and how you have how we have that meeting. We think that the language here where we're talking about due process requirements and that is just overly legalistic, and we think that we can reach an accommodation that gives the department what they want if the language spoke to something about they can be removed from school only after the district gives notice to the parent and provides an opportunity for the parent to meet with an appropriate administrator. Once we start putting due process, the words due process and that in there, we're afraid that this is going to end up kicking the appeal of this to federal court, and that we think we could work out some language with the department today or tomorrow or sometime in the very near future that would allow them to do what they wanted without possibly raising that issue. In Section 4, this is the electronic reporting of removals other than exclusions and expulsions. And our concern with this is that this is going to increase the number of these reports greatly, because this is going to pick up all the kinds of voluntary agreements that school districts enter into with parents. The kid has done something that's possibly would merit expulsion, and the school district and the parents work out a deal where the kid will go to either to another school district, or the kid will go to an ALC, or the kid will go into a different kind of a program. That's voluntary. It doesn't go on the kid's record as having been expelled or anything like that. Yes, it probably doesn't get reported to the department, but that's not the end of the world. It also, we think, possibly picks up unilateral removals of special education students. Under the federal law, a school can remove a student who commits a dangerous weapons violation or an illegal drug or controlled substances violation, or who inflicts serious bodily injury, to an interim alternative setting for 45 school days. When the conduct is deemed to be a manifestation of a disability, that removal to that interim setting is often implemented in lieu of an expulsion. Also, you have court-ordered injunctions and removals by a hearing officer because the special ed student is likely to harm himself or others. We just think that that's... all those things don't need to be reported to the department, and it's going to be a lot of paperwork, and it's going to get kids into the system that basically the parents wanted them out of the system, and that's why they were willing to agree. It may be that we can work something out with the department on this provision.
Okay. And I appreciate your efforts in doing that, Mr. Deans. Thank you.
One last piece.
Okay, Mr. Deans, we do have to move along. We have a number of articles yet to finish in 35 minutes.
Mr. Chair, we also have one remaining section in Article 2 that we skipped over, and that's the school accountability report that we have an amendment on. It's 1160, part of the 1160 amendment, and Kathy Wagner is here to talk about that.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Kathy Wagner. I work with the Department of Education and Information Technology. And I'm going to talk about Section 11, the 2006 School Accountability Report. We are requesting a one-time delay in the reporting of the test and accountability and school report card results due to the technical work that needs to be done in transferring the assessment system from the MCA-1 to the MCA-2s. Following the first administration of those tests, which will be May of this year, there's a lot of technical work that needs to be done to set what's called achievement levels. On the MCA-1s, these would be achievement levels 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Those levels all need to be reset on the new assessments. So there's 10 assessments that need to have achievement levels set, and then those achievement levels need to be balanced not only within grade but across grades. That work can take, a couple of months just to make sure that if there are any issues that arise, that there's adequate time to resolve those. Once that work is done, then we have to compute AYP, adequate yearly progress, with the new scores and the new achievement levels, and have all of that new computation be run through a quality control process. And so we're just asking for additional time, basically to lay a solid foundation for the new assessment and transition to the accountability program.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. This time, before we leave Article 2, we do have one other person that's asked to testify, Ms. Elsweiger. Ms. Elsweiger, good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, members. Mr. Chair, Jan Elsweiger, Education Minnesota. I would like to testify on page 16, section 10 about science teachers. And I simply have a question for you. Who do you want teaching our children? Education Minnesota will always stand for high-quality teachers. We are very concerned what's happening in Minnesota and that we are watering down the licensure requirements in Minnesota. We passed the bill out of this committee. You passed the bill out of this committee that significantly does that last week. The Science Teachers Organization has concerns with this provision. If you don't listen to the science teachers, who do you listen to? Have you had conversations with them? Do they think this would be good for kids? We are talking about accountability, student achievement. We want our kids to succeed. If the Science Teachers Organization, if Education Minnesota, the teachers have a concern with this, why would we water this down? You have variances We have other opportunities for teachers to become licensed, fully and appropriately licensed, so that we have qualified teachers teaching our kids. Education Minnesota doesn't want just anybody teaching our kids. We don't want it to be easy to become a teacher, because we want good, qualified, intelligent people who are effective to teach our kids. I'll just go back to when I was teaching fourth grade. There's great teachers out there. And some, you know, there's this one teacher who, you know, not everybody liked as much. But boy, after I got into her classroom and saw what she was doing, I went, wow, this person knows how to teach. My point is this. A person who with great personality and maybe has a four-year degree or maybe has a license in this area does not mean that they're going to be qualified to teach in another area. Because they have a four-year degree and they jump through some hoops doesn't mean that they would be qualified to teach our kids. I'm asking you, who do you want to teach our children? And what do they have to prove to do it? A test is a test. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Allswiger. Madam Commissioner, we have about a half hour left of this hearing. I'm looking at Articles 4 through 7, and figured we could go through those fairly rapidly and then spend the remainder of the time on Article 3. So, members, we're moving on to Article 4. We'll complete the bill and come back to Article 3 for the remainder of the hearing. Dr. Melcher, welcome once again.
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Article 4, Section 1 of the bill is replaced with the amendment AO6 1160 on page 2, lines 6 through 17. This deals with the requirement for each school board to publish its budget in the newspaper by October 1st, including a comparison with the actual revenues, expenditures, and fund balances from the prior year. Under the amendment, the recommendation is, instead of repealing the requirement, which is what the original bill would have done, this would move the requirement from October 1st to November 30th, which would be consistent with the current statutory requirement for reporting of final UFARS data. One of the concerns that school districts have raised about this provision currently is that it requires them to publish data that may be inaccurate because it's 2 months before their deadline for publication of final UFARS data. This would align the two so that the publication would be due on the same date as the final expenditure revenue data from the prior school year. The second thing that this amendment would do would be to provide another option to the school district. Currently, they must publish this detailed budget information in the newspaper. This would give the school district the option of publishing the information on the district's official website. If they also published in the newspaper a notice that the information was being published on the district's website and provided the website address so that the public could access it via the web. This would actually provide better access to the public to this information, because rather than being published in the newspaper on a single day, it would be available on the district's website for the public to look at when they sought this information.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Melcher. Madam Commissioner, Article 5.
Mr. Kaser.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Barry Schaefer. I'm the Director of Adult Basic Education at the Department
Welcome
of Education.
Schaefer.
There's two changes requested in regards to adult basic education. The first one is Section 1, and Section 1 has to do with a reporting date change in law. 6 years ago, when the ABE formula was revamped and renewed, there was a date put in, a specific time period for reporting put in the law. back when we didn't have electronic reporting available to us, and that date ended our contact hour year and our student outcome reporting year as April 30th. We now have better technology to get more updated information quicker and processed quicker. We would like the flexibility for the department to set those reporting dates and not have to come back to the legislature each year to reestablish a reporting year. On Section 2, our other change is having to do with the adult diploma program. 3 years ago, the adult basic education program became the administrative program for adult graduation aid, and we discovered there were no entrance requirements into the adult diploma program. And we want the flexibility for the department to establish an eligibility criteria to conform to our current policy of establishing a sixth grade reading level to get into our adult program levels as an eligibility requirement. And to exit the diploma program with the diploma, we would like to have all adult students getting their diploma also pass the state's graduation test. That would be the exit criteria. So those are the changes that we're asking in adult-based education.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. And seeing no questions, we'll move on. I'm sorry, Representative Quincy.
Thank you. Just a quick question about the number of adults in the program right now who might be coming in with a reading level below sixth grade.
Of 80,000 enrollees in the past year, probably our ESL population has the highest number below the sixth grade, and they're taking ESL classes. I would say three-quarters of our 80,000 individuals are taking lower-level either ESL or adult basic education classes. We only have about 1,200 students in our adult diploma program, per se, graduate each year, so it's much fewer in that adult diploma arena.
What Representative Quincy?
So the students who are not in going to be served in the ELL program, what other programs are available for them to help them get to the sixth grade level?
Mr. Schaefer.
Representative. Our adult basic education program for native English speakers has six levels to it. The highest level is adult diploma and GED level. So there are five functional levels defined in our law that we use to administer adult basic education. And those individuals are from zero grading level, grade level, all the way through 10th grade level. And once you reach the 10th grade level in our system and are being served through our ABE system, then you may enter the GED or the adult diploma level. So there are five other levels of adult basic education.
Members, we'll move on to Article 6, Early Childhood Education. Madam Commissioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Michelle Weber with the Department of Education. The primary reason for amending Article 6, or for proposing Article 6, is to change the word grantee in the Head Start program to program. Currently, there is a formula designated in statute for allocating the funds to programs, and we go through an administratively burdensome process both for the programs and for the department in awarding grant contracts every 2 years. Section 1 of Article 6 determines the allocation, and Section 2 identifies all federally designated Head Start programs. This would allow one additional program in the state to receive state funding. It eliminates unnecessary language that results from the addition of Minnesota Statute 119A.535. Section 3 also just changes the term program or grantee to programs, and it also clarifies under which section innovative initiatives are allowed. In Section 4, we've added a new section to the statute, 0.535, which describes the application process that programs would go through to receive funds from the department. Section 5 simply changes the term grant teacher programs and also eliminates specific legislative committee names because committee titles tend to change. Section 6 allows for the carryover from 1 year of the biennium into the second year of the biennium for funds that are not expended by the local programs. And Section 7 repeals definitions that are no longer applicable to the program.
Thank you very much, Representative Farley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Weber, when on Section 2, you're striking all the work plan language and then referencing Statute 119A.535. Does that include basically the same thing, or was something, what is the difference in that statute versus the work plan that's here?
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the application requirements that we're including in Section 535.535 actually indicate additional information that we'll be asking for. The work plan was a broad statement, and we have the grantees submit an annual application that includes a work plan, includes a budget, etc.
Representative Sakara.
I'll try to make this quick. I think here you're talking strictly about the federal dollars that come to Head Start, not about the state dollars that go into Head Start. Or does this include inability for the state to make any changes in the state Head Start dollars?
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sakura, this is in reference to the state funding, which is to supplement the federal funds that are designated to the program. So this is language change relating to the appropriation of the state funds. And it's appropriating the funds in the same manner. It's rather than entering into a grant contract, appropriating through the formula that's already designated in statute.
Just a clarification.
Representative Sakura.
What I'm asking you, since you say that everybody has to get the same level that they had been getting before, does that mean the state could never cut the millions of dollars going to Head Start if, say, we learn that there's maybe a better way to deal with at-risk children through some other program? This is strictly, you know, a hypothetical idea, but I would like to think that this doesn't mandate that the state dollars always follow exactly as they do right now.
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sakura, I believe you're referring to page 37, lines 37.3 and 37.4.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? That's just a rewording of that sentence. That requirement was previously in the statute, that programs who received funding would not receive less than they received in 1993. The rewording of this sentence is a reflection of the new Head Start program that has been added to the state from the federal level since that time. So what this language is doing is it's assuring that programs that were in existence in 1993 do not receive less state funding than they received prior to that time.
Right. Representative Biskins, may I ask one more thing?
Representative Sakura.
Do you understand that there are areas of the state which no longer have enough students to even use that Head Start funding? Do you understand that? And that sometimes it might be wise to reallocate some of those dollars, for instance, from a very rural area where they are short of preschool children. And we had a county last year that didn't have any new births. And to reallocate that maybe to another area where there are lots of children in need? Is that not possible now?
Madam Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, to answer Representative Sakura's question, this language here is just very technical language to change grantees to programs. It doesn't preclude anyone from looking at the current state formula and how it's applied and changing it in a policy discussion. What Ms. Weber is explaining here today is just we're trying to conform our what we're actually doing in practice in the department in awarding programs, not grantees, trying to make the process a little bit more transparent and clear to the Head Start program. This is purely technical. It doesn't preclude all of you discussing other ways of allocating the state money.
Thank you. Ms. Weber, would you finish by telling us what's being repealed on line 30 of page 38?
Yes, this section includes definitions that are outdated. They refer to program codes. Staff development and startup are defined, and those are not, those definitions are no longer necessary. The funding does not follow those definitions for program codes.
All right, thank you very much. Madam Commissioner, Article 7.
That would be Department of Finance. Okay. Yes, Mr. Schaefer.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Sullivan.
I mean, sorry. I say Schaefer, I'm in Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, this recommendation comes to us from the Minnesota Academies and Department of Finance, and I thought someone was going to be here today for that, but they're not. The recommendation is due to an error the Academies committed in 2001 to 2003. They incorrectly deposited approximately $102,000 in a general revenue account, a general grant revenue in its special revenue fund instead of the general fund. They received that in lieu of out-of-state tuition from an independent school district in Iowa. Minnesota law though requires them to put this money in the general fund and then credit it to the operating account. So the auditor, those who audited the books of the academies, recommended that the academies seek a statutory change to allow general education grant revenues to be deposited in its special revenue fund so that they have access to that money.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Before we move into Article 3, a very quick question, Madam Commissioner. The total of the bill on line 4 carrying into line 5 says appropriating money. And I said appropriations in Article 3. I have not seen any appropriation up to this point. Is that a mistake in the title, Madam Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I think that that's probably very traditional language that, you know, follows any bill. I imagine with any effect that you have on changes in revenue, even if they're technical changes, that they're adjusting the requirements, let's say, that districts have for creating reserves or doing any other kinds of things, that that does affect revenue.
Madam Commissioner, in this bill, is there any request for new appropriations?
No, not that I know of.
Thank you. The author has a reputation to keep. let's move on then to Article 3.
Mr. Representative Biskin,
Dr. Nelson
always wanting to be very careful. In the APID area, we do adjust how the APID revenue is distributed, but again, there is not any additional appropriation. So just want to make that clear that there is a little adjustment there.
Thank you, Madam Commissioner. On to Article 3, Ms. Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Article 3 has an amendment, and it's basically the entire article. It's Amendment
8061189. And members, that amendment has already been incorporated into the bill, so we will turn our attention to the 1189 amendment for the rest of the day.
Thank you.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 3 deals a lot with special ed provisions, and sections 1 through 10 are mostly changes that are made that are being made pursuant to IDEA 2004, the federal law that was just reauthorized. Minnesota statutes incorporated much of the language from IDEA 1997, and so in order to conform with the new federal law, a lot of these changes are to reflect that change in federal law. There are a few provisions that are not quite as technical as that, but for the most part, that's the general idea. And the reason we're moving with these particular provisions and not everything pursuant to IDEA 2004 is, for the most part, again, these provisions are ones that there basically wasn't a policy decision to make. It was because of the language we have in Minnesota statutes. To conform with the federal law, we need to move the language.
So,
with that, Section 1, it deals with the parental consent provisions, where we're basically laying out the difference between consenting to initial eval versus initial services and then a re-eval and provision of services, and where a district can override parents' consent or refusal to consent to those particular provisions. The significant change is in Section F, which deals with when a school district can override a parental consent not to re-eval their student. And this is to allow the school district their due process procedures, which would be all of the alternative dispute resolution procedures or a due process hearing, to override when a parent refuses to have or refuses to allow their student to be reevaluated. And the problem that we have been hearing is if the district cannot override the parental consent, that basically ties the district's hands with respect to doing new testing or reevaluating that student, and students are often then in a placement that may not be appropriate for that student, but because you cannot change the placement without doing a re-eval, you cannot move the student from an incorrect placement. Section 2 deals with Minnesota's Conciliation Conference. Section 2 ties to Section 7 through 10. The federal law, the new IDEA 2004, introduced a concept called a resolution session, which is basically an alternative dispute resolution process to happen after a hearing has been requested. The federal law basically finally caught up to what Minnesota does. Minnesota has had in place for many years the Conciliation Conference, which is an opportunity for the district and the parents to resolve a conflict before going to a hearing. As you're aware, hearings are costly, they're time-consuming, and they're generally not the best solution for students, parents, and the district. So to the extent that we can try to resolve conflicts before they reach that level, that's what Minnesota has traditionally argued for. So the Conciliation Conference, because of the new federal provision, we did not want to get rid of the Conciliation Conference, but are trying to find a way to allow these processes to coexist peacefully. So the Conciliation Conference can occur any time. A resolution session per IDEA 2004 occurs after a hearing has been requested and before you actually go to hearing. So that's what Section 2, and then again some language that we come to later, is attempting to resolve. Section 3 is already codified language that is just being relocated per making all of these changes. Section 4 is also in light of IDEA 2004, which now says that mediated agreements are must be written and are binding agreements, and that is a change from how mediation has been handled in the past. Section 5 introduces a statute of limitations to a due process hearing, in effect saying disputes that arose within 2 years are within the jurisdiction of a due process hearing. The Section 6 deals with hearing officer qualifications, and again, we're trying to clean up Minnesota's language in light of what IDEA 2004 requires. And then again, we're reaching Section 7 through 10, which all deal with this idea of marrying the Conciliation Conference to the resolution session and trying to make sure that they can coexist together. So those are sections 1 to 10.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, Member Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Section 11 is correcting a technical drafting error from last year's bill in the special education tuition billing language.
Commissioner next. Okay, thank you. Identify yourself for the tape and please proceed.
Good morning, I'm Barbara O'Sullivan with Early Learning Services, Minnesota Department of Education. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm going to be presenting sections 12 through 18, early intervention services for infants and toddlers with disabilities.
birth to 3 years of age. And the purpose of this is to update Minnesota statutes to reflect the 2004 federal reauthorization of IDEA. And as we go through these, you'll see they're looking at outreach to specific populations, as in Section 12 under interagency child crimes systems, with outreach to children who have substantiated abuse or neglect cases or have been affected by illegal substance abuse and exposure. Section 13 addresses the State Interagency Coordinating Council, which is members are appointed by the governor, and we're requesting that the state law refer to the federal law to reflect the council membership. Section 14 looks at responsibilities of the county boards and school boards who are responsible for facilitating services at the local level. Again, it's looking at specific services for populations for American Indian infants and toddlers with disabilities and their families, as well as outreach to those who are homeless or wards of the state. Section 15 is looking at the local level with the Interagency Early Intervention Committee. Again, outreach to parents with premature infants or infants with other risk factors. As we mentioned before, substantiated cases of abuse and neglect or exposure to illegal substance abuse, and with the purpose of reducing the need for further services. Section 16 looks at the Individualized Family Service Plan, the IFSP. Federal law has asked that we track results around pre-literacy and language skills for young children, as well as this addresses the timeline in helping with a transition plan for children as they leave Part C services into Part B services, special education, or into other health or human services they may require. Section 17 is service coordination. Again, addressing the timeline for a transition plan for a child no longer eligible for early intervention services. And then Section 18 looks at the state interagency agreement with outreach to underserved groups. So,
thank you, Ms. O'Sullivan. And then we have a few sections left. Ms. Roberts.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Sections 19 through 25, 28 and 29 all deal with care and treatment provisions and or residential facility provisions. Minnesota Statute 125A515 and Minnesota Rule 3525.2325 both purport to deal with students who are placed for care and treatment and the minimum amount of services that a district is required to provide those children. Minnesota Statute 125A.515 was amended a few years ago, and I believe inadvertently there was a subsection of children who were basically left out of the protections of the statute, and because of the way the statute was worded, Minnesota Rule no longer applies to them as well. So that there is a group of kids who are not protected by this minimum level of service, and instead they are to be served according to the district, which then leads to a number of disparate amount of service that those kids are receiving depending on if you're, you know, in District A or District B. So our attempt here was to basically divide the statute from the rule and refer to the statute as children who are placed in residential licensed facilities, and these are facilities that are licensed by DOC or DHS, and they are residential programs, and have the statute apply to those students, while the care and treatment provisions would then apply in rule would then apply to the children who are defined as placed for care and treatment per the rule. So it's an attempt to separate those concepts and ensure that the subgroup of children who were left out are now back under the protection of Minnesota Rule. And those kids are those who are at home due to sickness or illness or sickness or accident,
placed in a mental health program, day treatment, or hospitals. And this is in excess of 15 consecutive days or greater, that placement, intermittently or for 15 days straight.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Representative Abler.
I know we're almost out of time, but I wanted to leave one person to comment about the concern about Article 3, pages 1 and 2 in the amendment, which is referenced now, and there's no time to discuss it, but especially paragraph C and F, where the parent can be carved out of that process. And I maybe just answer in brief, this is to conform with federal rules, but I'm still uncomfortable with it, even if it is. So, is this a federal requirement they're trying to get us to?
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair and Representative Abler, C is a change pursuant to the federal law, and I believe questions have been raised about that federally as well, but it is in IDEA 2004 as a Section D. And then the
Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, when they come back, I'd like to know if we're allowed to exceed federal criteria. There's many times we're conforming with federal stuff that we give up a lot, not even knowing we don't have to. So that's just my point. Thank you.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, Ms. Weber, I don't want to go through the other bill, but just generally speaking, why do we have this amendment? Is there anything substantive was left out or added in? Or
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, this particular, the Article 3 amendment, is that what you're referring to?
Ms. Weber, yes.
The biggest substantive change, I think, are the care and treatment provisions, where we are really trying to get this group of children back into a minimum level of service. Mm-hmm. And also the parental consent provision that allows the district to override the parent's refusal for re-eval. I think that those are the two most significant.
Mr. Chair. Madam Commissioner.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Greiling, I think maybe Amy didn't quite hear your question. You wanted to know what the substantive differences were in the original bill and in this. There aren't a lot of substantive issues. There's some technical changes. For example, in Clause C, the wording was changed from a must to a may. And that is in regard to parental consent. That would be on page 1, line 122. And Ms. Roberts can probably highlight some of the other things. But it was more clarification of some of the staff had clarification questions, and so we tried to work with them just to make sure that there was an understanding of timelines, calendar days versus business days, those kinds of things. So instead of trying to have you going back and forth, we just put it all in one amendment today.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fairlane, I apologize, I did mishear that, and the Commissioner is correct. House research staff had a few suggestions that I think actually do clarify and state better what the department was attempting to state. So,
thank you, Ms. Roberts. Questions? Representative Rood.
Thank you. I just want to clarify. I actually have a constituent who, and I just wanted to make sure that this correction is going to address their needs, the child who had the immunodeficiency.
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, Representative Rood, that's our intent.
Great.
So I believe it should.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Roberts and Commissioner Segrin. And Karen Ephraim, I believe you're up to the testifying table. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch as well as several other national groups to strongly testify against Article 3, Section 1, the overriding of parental refusal for special education evaluations and reevaluations. I have a lot to say, but very briefly, the current law, the way it is constituted right now, that the districts cannot override parental consent, was passed several years ago in this committee two votes short of unanimous, which is a highly unusual event for a partisan committee. The federal law upon which it was based is Title 20 of the U.S. Code, Chapter 33, Section 1414. That has not changed with the new reauthorization of IDEA. It says, and I quote, if the parent of such child does not provide consent of an initial evaluation under Clause 1-1 or the parent fails to respond to requests to provide the consent, the local educational agency may pursue the initial evaluation of the child by utilizing the procedures described in Section 615, except to the extent inconsistent with state law regarding such parental consent. We have the right as a state to say what our parental consent laws will be. That survived conference committee. It had the support of groups as diverse as EdWatch and the NAACP. The President's Commission on Special Education, the National Academy Press Report on Minorities in Special Education notes the over-identification of minorities and the over-drugging of minorities. The NAACP is very concerned about that. And there is no reason to change current law. I'd be happy to give you details, but I know that you are pressed for time.
Thank you, Ms. Efron, and I appreciate that. Members, at this time, we're going to adjourn the meeting. I ask that you put this material into your folder in the to save folder, or you bring it, keep it and bring it back with you. Madam Commissioner, I thank you very much for participating in this hearing this morning. The chair will waive this bill over for future consideration. This meeting is now adjourned.